The Double Clue. But above everything, no publicity, said Mr. Marcus Hardman for perhaps the 14th time. The word publicity occurred throughout his conversation with the regularity of a leitmotif. Mr. Hardman was a small man, delicately plump, with exquisitely manicured hands and a plaintive tenor voice. In his way, he was somewhat of a celebrity, and the fashionable life was his profession. He was rich, but not remarkably so, and he spent his money zealously in the pursuit of social pleasure. His hobby was collecting. He had the collector's soul. Old lace, old fans, antique jewelry, nothing crude or modern for Marcus Hardman. Poirot and I, obeying an urgent summons, had arrived to find the little man writhing in an agony of indecision. Under the circumstances, to call in the police was abhorrent to him. On the other hand, not to call them in was to acquiesce in the loss of some of the gems of his collection. He hit upon Poirot as a compromise. My rubies, Monsieur Poirot, and the emerald necklace said to have belonged to Catherine de' Medici. Oh, the emerald necklace! If you will recount to me the circumstances of their disappearance, suggested Poirot gently, I am endeavouring to do so. Yesterday afternoon I had a little tea party, quite an informal affair, some half a dozen people or so. I have given one or two of them during the season, and though perhaps I should not say so, they have been quite a success. Some good music, Nakora the pianist, and Catherine Bird, the Australian contralto, in the big studio. Well, early in the afternoon I was showing my guests my collection of medieval jewels. I keep them in the small wall safe over there. It is arranged like a cabinet inside, with coloured velvet background, to display the stones. Afterwards, we inspected the fans, in the case on the wall. Then we all went to the studio for music. It was not until after everyone had gone that I discovered the safe rifled. I must have failed to shut it properly. Someone had seized the opportunity to denude it of its contents. The rubies, Monsieur Poirot, the emerald necklace, the collection of a lifetime. What would I not give to recover them? But there must be no publicity. You fully understand that, do you not, Monsieur Poirot? My own guests, my own personal friends, it would be a horrible scandal. Who was the last person to leave this room when you went to the studio? A Mr. Johnston. You may know him, the South African millionaire. He's just rented the Abbotsbury's house in Park Lane. He lingered behind a few moments, I remember, but surely, oh, surely it couldn't be he. Did any of your guests return to this room during the afternoon on any pretext? Now, I was prepared for that question, Monsieur Poirot. Three of them did so. Countess Vera Rosikoff, Mr. Bernard Parker, and Lady Runcorn. Well, let us hear about them. Well, the Countess Rosikoff is a very charming Russian lady, a member of the old regime. She has recently come to this country. She had bade me goodbye, and I was therefore somewhat surprised to find her in this room, apparently gazing in rapture at my cabinet of fans. You know, Monsieur Poirot, the more I think of it, the more suspicious it seems to me. Don't you agree? Extremely suspicious. But let us hear about the others. Well, Parker simply came here to fetch a case of miniatures that I was anxious to show to Lady Runcorn. And Lady Runcorn herself? Well, as I dare say you know, Lady Runcorn is a middle-aged woman of considerable force of character who devotes most of her time to various charitable committees. She simply returned to fetch a handbag she had laid down somewhere. Bien, monsieur. So, we have four possible suspects. The Russian Countess, the English Grande Dame, the South African millionaire, and Mr. Bernard Parker. Who is Mr. Parker, by the way? The question appeared to embarrass Mr. Hardman considerably. He is, he is a young fellow, a young fellow I know. I had already deduced as much, replied Poirot gravely. What does he do, this Mr. Parker? Well, he's a young man about town, not perhaps quite in the swim, if I may so express myself. How did he come to be a friend of yours, may I ask? Well, on one or two occasions he has performed certain little commissions for me. Continue, monsieur, said Poirot. Hardman looked piteously at him. Evidently the last thing he wanted to do was to continue, but as Poirot maintained an inexorable silence, he capitulated. You see, Monsieur Poirot, it is well known that I am interested in antique jewels. Sometimes there is a family heirloom to be disposed of, which, mind you, would never be sold in the open market, or to a dealer. But a private sale to me is a very different matter. Parker arranges the details of such things. He is in touch with both sides, and thus any little embarrassment is avoided. He brings anything of that kind to my notice. For instance, the Countess Rosikoff has brought some family jewels with her from Russia. She is anxious to sell them. Bernard Parker was to have arranged the transaction. I see, said Poirot thoughtfully. And you trust him implicitly? Well, I have no reason to do otherwise. Mr. Hardman, of these four people, which do you yourself suspect? Oh, Monsieur Poirot, what a question. Well, they are my friends. As I told you, I suspect none of them, or all of them, whichever way you like to put it. I do not agree. You suspect one of those four. It is not Countess Rosakoff. It is not Mr. Parker. Is it Lady Runcorn or Mr. Johnston? You drive me into a corner, Monsieur Poirot. You do indeed. I'm most anxious to have no scandal. Lady Runcorn belongs to one of the oldest families in England. But it is true, it is most unfortunately true, that her aunt, Lady Caroline, suffered from a most melancholy affliction. It was understood, of course, by all her friends, and her maid returned the teaspoons, or whatever it was, as promptly as possible. You see my predicament. So, Lady Runcorn had an aunt who was a kleptomaniac. Very interesting. You permit that I examine the safe? Mr. Hardman assenting, Poirot pushed back the door of the safe and examined the interior. The empty velvet-lined shelves gaped at us. Even now, the door does not shut properly, murmured Poirot, as he swung it to and fro. I wonder why. Ah, what have we here? A glove caught in the hinge. A man's glove. He held it out to Mr. Hardman. Oh, that's not one of my gloves, the latter declared. Aha, something more. Poirot bent deftly and picked up a small object from the floor of the safe. It was a flat cigarette case, made of black moire. My cigarette case, cried Mr. Hardman. Yours? Surely not, monsieur. Those are not your initials. He pointed to an entwined monogram of two letters, executed in platinum. Hardman took it in his hand. Oh, you are right, he declared. It's very like mine, but the initials are different. A B and a P. Good heavens. Parker. It would seem so, said Poirot. A somewhat careless young man, especially if the glove is his also. That would be a double clue, would it not? Bernard Parker, murmured Hardman. What a relief. Well, Monsieur Poirot, I leave it to you to recover the jewels. Place the matter in the hands of the police if you think fit. That is, if you are quite sure that it is he who is guilty. See you, my friend, said Poirot to me as we left the house together. He has one law for the titled and another law for the plain, this Mr. Hardman. Me, I have not yet been ennobled, so I am on the side of the plain. I have sympathy for this young man. The whole thing was a little curious, was it not? There was Hardman suspecting Lady Runcorn. There was I suspecting the Countess and Johnston. And all the time, the obscure Mr. Parker was our man. Why did you suspect the other two? Parbleu, it is such a simple thing to be a Russian refugee or a South African millionaire. Any woman can call herself a Russian countess. Anyone can buy a house in Park Lane and call himself a South African millionaire. Who is going to contradict them? But I observe that we are passing through Berry Street. Our careless young friend lives here. Let us, as you say, strike while the iron is in the fire. Mr. Bernard Parker was at home. We found him reclining on some cushions, clad in an amazing dressing gown of purple and orange. I have seldom taken a greater dislike to anyone than I did to this particular young man with his white, effeminate face and affected, lisping speech. Good morning, monsieur, said Poirot briskly. I come from Mr. Hardman. Yesterday at the party, somebody has stolen all his jewels. Permit me to ask you, monsieur, is this your glove? Mr. Parker's mental processes did not seem very rapid. He stared at the glove, as though gathering his wits together. Where did you find it? He asked at last. Is it your glove, monsieur? Mr. Parker appeared to make up his mind. No, it isn't, he declared. And this cigarette case, is that yours? Certainly not. I always carry a silver one. Very well, monsieur. I go to put matters in the hands of the police. Oh, I say, I wouldn't do that if I were you, cried Mr. Parker in some concern. Beastly, unsympathetic people, the police. Wait a bit. I'll go round and see old Hardman. Look here. Oh, stop a minute. But Poirot beat a determined retreat. We have given him something to think about, have we not? He chuckled. Tomorrow we will observe what has occurred. But we were destined to have a reminder of the Hardman case that afternoon. Without the least warning, the door flew open, and a whirlwind in human form invaded our privacy, bringing with her a swirl of sables. It was as cold as only an English June day can be, and a hat rampant with slaughtered ospreys, Countess Vera Rosikoff was a somewhat disturbing personality.
You are Monsieur Poirot? What is this that you have done? You accuse that poor boy. It is infamous. It is scandalous. I know him. He is a chicken, a lamb. Never would he steal. He has done everything for me. Will I stand by and see him martyred and butchered?
Tell me, madame, is this his cigarette case? Poirot held out the black moire case. The countess paused for a moment while she inspected it.
Yes, it is his. I know it well. What of it? Did you find it in the room? We were all there. He dropped it then, I suppose. Ah, you policemen, you are worse than the Red Guards.
And is this his glove? How should I know?
One glove is like another. Do not try to stop me. He must be set free. His character must be cleared. You shall do it. I will sell my jewels and give you much money.
Madame, it is agreed then?
No. Do not argue. The poor boy. He came to me, tears in his eyes. I will save you, I said. I will go to this man, this ogre, this monster. Leave it to Vera. Now it is settled. I go.
With as little ceremony as she had come, she swept from the room, leaving an overpowering perfume of an exotic nature behind her. What a woman, I exclaimed. And what furs!
Ah, yes, they were genuine enough. Could a spurious countess have real furs?
My little joke, Hastings. No, she is truly Russian, I fancy.
Well, well, so Master Bernard went bleating to her.
Well, the cigarette case is his. I wonder if the glove is also. With a smile, Poirot drew from his pocket a second glove and placed it by the first. There was no doubt of there being a pair.
Where did you get the second one, Poirot?
It was thrown down with a stick on the table in the hall in Berry Street. Truly, a very careless young man, Monsieur Parker. Well, well, mon ami, we must be thorough. Just for the form of the thing, I will make a little visit to Park Lane. Needless to say, I accompanied my friend. Johnston was out, but we saw his private secretary. It transpired that Johnston had only recently arrived from South Africa. He had never been in England before.
He is interested in precious stones, is he not? Hazarded Poirot.
Gold mining is nearer the mark, laughed the secretary. Poirot came away from the interview thoughtful. Late that evening, to my utter surprise, I found him earnestly studying a Russian grammar.
Good heavens, Poirot, I cried. Are you learning Russian in order to converse with the countess in her own language?
She certainly would not listen to my English, my friend. But surely, Poirot, well-born Russians invariably speak French.
You are a mine of information, Hastings.
I will cease puzzling over the intricacies of the Russian alphabet. He threw the book from him with a dramatic gesture. I was not entirely satisfied. There was a twinkle in his eye which I knew of old. It was an invariable sign that Hercule Poirot was pleased with himself.
Perhaps, I said sapiently, you doubt her being really a Russian.
You are going to test her?
Ah, no. She is Russian, all right.
Well then, if you really want to distinguish yourself over this case, Hastings, I recommend First Steps in Russian as an invaluable aid. Then he laughed and would say no more. I picked up the book from the floor and dipped into it curiously, but could make neither head nor tail of Poirot's remarks. The following morning brought us no news of any kind. But that did not seem to worry my little friend. At breakfast, he announced his intention of calling upon Mr. Hardman early in the day. We found the elderly social butterfly at home, and seemingly a little calmer than on the previous day.
Well, Monsieur Poirot, any news?
He demanded eagerly. Poirot handed him a slip of paper.
That is the person who took the jewels, Monsieur. Shall I put matters in the hands of the police, or would you prefer me to recover the jewels without bringing the police into the matter?
Mr. Hardman was staring at the paper. At last he found his voice.
Most astonishing. I should infinitely prefer to have no scandal in the matter. I will give you carte blanche, Monsieur Poirot. I'm sure you will be discreet.
Our next procedure was to hail a taxi, which Poirot ordered to drive to the Carlton. There he inquired for Countess Rosikoff. In a few minutes we were ushered up into the lady's suite. She came to meet us with outstretched hands, arrayed in a marvelous negligee of barbaric design.
Monsieur Poirot, she cried. You have succeeded. You have cleared that poor infant.
Madame la Comtesse, your friend Mr. Parker is perfectly safe from arrest.
Ah, but you are the clever little man. Superb. And so quickly, too.
On the other hand, I have promised Mr. Hardman that the jewels shall be returned to him today.
So?
Therefore, madame, I should be extremely obliged if you would place them in my hands without delay. I am sorry to hurry you, but I am keeping a taxi, in case it should be necessary for me to go on to Scotland Yard. And we Belgians, madame, we practice the thrift. The Countess had lighted a cigarette. For some seconds she sat perfectly still, blowing smoke rings and gazing steadily at Poirot. Then she burst into a laugh and rose. She went across to the bureau, opened a drawer, and took out a black silk handbag. She tossed it lightly to Poirot. Her tone, when she spoke, was perfectly light and unmoved.
"We Russians, on the contrary, practice prodigality," she said. "And to do that, unfortunately, one must have money. You need not look inside. They are all there."
Poirot arose. "I congratulate you, madame, on your quick intelligence and your promptitude."
"Ah, but since you were keeping a taxi waiting, what else could I do?"
"You are too amiable, madame. You are remaining long in London?"
"I am afraid no, owing to you."
"Accept my apologies."
"We shall meet again elsewhere, perhaps."
"I hope so."
"And I do not," exclaimed the Countess with a laugh. "It is a great compliment that I pay you there. There are very few men in the world whom I fear. Goodbye, Monsieur Poirot."
"Goodbye, Madame la Comtesse. Ah, pardon me. I forgot. Allow me to return to you your cigarette case." And with a bow, he handed to her the little black moiré case we had found in the safe. She accepted it without any change of expression, just a lifted eyebrow and a murmured, "I see."
"What a woman!" cried Poirot enthusiastically as we descended the stairs. "Mon Dieu, quelle femme! Not a word of argument, of protestation, of bluff, one quick glance, and she had sized up the position correctly. I tell you, Hastings, a woman who can accept defeat like that with a careless smile will go far. She is dangerous. She has the nerves of steel. She..." He tripped heavily. "If you can manage to moderate your transports and look where you're going, it might be as well," I suggested. "When did you first suspect the Countess?"
"Mon ami, it was the glove and the cigarette case, the double clue, shall we say, that worried me. Bernard Parker might easily have dropped one or the other, but hardly both. Ah no, that would have been too careless. In the same way, if someone else had placed them there to incriminate Parker, one would have been sufficient, the cigarette case or the glove. Again, not both. So I was forced to the conclusion that one of the two things did not belong to Parker. I imagined at first that the case was his and that the glove was not. But when I discovered the fellow to the glove, I saw it was the other way about. Whose, then, was the cigarette case? Clearly, it could not belong to Lady Runcorn. The initials were wrong. Mr. Johnston? Only if he were here under a false name. I interviewed his secretary, and it was apparent at once that everything was clear and above board. There was no reticence about Mr. Johnson's past. The Countess, then? She was supposed to have brought jewels with her from Russia. She had only to take the stones from their settings, and it was extremely doubtful if they could ever be identified. What could be easier for her than to pick up one of Parker's gloves from the hall that day and thrust it into the safe? But bien sûr, she did not intend to drop her own cigarette case. But if the case was hers, why did it have BP on it? Countess's initials are VR. Poirot smiled gently upon me. Exactly, mon ami. But in the Russian alphabet, B is V and P is R. Well, you couldn't expect me to guess that. I don't know Russian, neither do I, Hastings. That is why I bought my little book and urged it on your attention. He sighed. A remarkable woman. I have a feeling, my friend, a very decided feeling. I shall meet her again. Where, I wonder?
Finessing the King. It was a wet Wednesday in the offices of the International Detective Agency. Tuppence let the Daily Leader fall idly from her hand. "Do you know what I've been thinking, Tommy?" "It's impossible to say," replied her husband. "You think of so many things, and you think of them all at once." "I think it's time we went dancing again." Tommy picked up the Daily Leader hastily. "Our advertisement looks well," he remarked, his head on one side. "Blunt's Brilliant Detectives." "Do you realize, Tuppence, that you, and you alone, are Blunt's Brilliant Detectives? There's glory for you, as Humpty Dumpty would say. I was talking about dancing. There's a curious point that I've observed about newspapers. I wonder if you've ever noticed it. Take these three copies of the Daily Leader. Can you tell me how they differ, one from the other? Tuppence took them with some curiosity. Seems fairly easy, she remarked witheringly. One is today's, one is yesterday's, and one is the day before's. Positively scintillating, my dear Watson, but that was not my meaning. Observe the headline, Daily Leader. Compare the three. Do you see any difference between them? No, I don't, said Tuppence. And what's more, I don't believe there is any. Tommy sighed and brought the tips of his fingers together in the most approved Sherlock Holmes fashion. Exactly. Yet you read the papers as much, in fact more, than I do. But I have observed, and you have not. If you will look at today's Daily Leader, you will see that in the middle of the downstroke of the D is a small white dot, and there is another in the L of the same word. But in yesterday's paper, the white dot is not in daily at all. There are two white dots in the L of leader. That of the day before again has two dots in the D of daily. In fact, the dot, or dots, are in a different position every day. Why? Asked Tuppence. That's a journalistic secret. Meaning you don't know and can't guess. I will merely say this, the practice is common to all newspapers. Aren't you clever? Said Tuppence. Especially at drawing red herrings across the track. Let's go back to what we were talking about before. What were we talking about? The Three Arts Ball, Tommy groaned. No, no, Tuppence, not the Three Arts Ball. I'm not young enough, I assure you, I'm not young enough. When I was a nice young girl, said Tuppence, I was brought up to believe that men, especially husbands, were dissipated beings fond of drinking and dancing and staying up late at night. It took an exceptionally beautiful and clever wife to keep them at home. Another illusion gone. All the wives I know are hankering to go out and dance and weeping because their husbands will wear bedroom slippers and go to bed at 9:30. And you do dance so nicely, Tommy, dear. Gently with the butter, Tuppence. As a matter of fact, said Tuppence, it's not purely for pleasure that I want to go. I'm intrigued by this advertisement. She picked up the Daily Leader again and read it out. I should go 3 hearts, 12 tricks, ace of spades, necessary to finesse the king. Rather an expensive way of learning bridge, was Tommy's comment. Don't be an ass, that's nothing to do with bridge. You see, I was lunching with a girl yesterday at the Ace of Spades. It's a queer little underground den in Chelsea, and she told me that it's quite the fashion at these big shows to trundle round there in the course of the evening for bacon and eggs and Welsh rarebits, bohemian sort of stuff. It's got screened-off booths all round it. Pretty hot place, I should say. And your idea is, 3 hearts stands for the 3 arts ball tomorrow night. 12 tricks is 12 o'clock. And the ace of spades is the ace of spades. And what about its being necessary to finesse the king? Well, that's what I thought we'd find out. I shouldn't wonder if you weren't right, Tuppence, said Tommy magnanimously. But I don't quite see why you want to butt in upon other people's love affairs. I shan't butt in. What I'm proposing is an interesting experiment in detective work. We need practice. Business is certainly not too brisk, agreed Tommy. All the same, Tuppence, what you want is to go to the 3 arts ball and dance. Talk of red herrings. Tuppence laughed shamelessly. Oh, be a sport, Tommy. Try and forget you're 32 and have got one grey hair in your left eyebrow. I was always weak where women were concerned, murmured her husband. Have I got to make an ass of myself in fancy dress? Of course, but you can leave that to me. I've got a splendid idea. Tommy looked at her with some misgiving. He was always profoundly mistrustful of Tuppence's brilliant ideas. When he returned to the flat on the following evening, Tuppence came flying out of her bedroom to meet him. It's come, she announced. What's come? The costume. Come and look at it. Tommy followed her. Spread out on the bed was a complete fireman's kit with shining helmet. Good God, groaned Tommy. Have I joined the Wembley Fire Brigade? Guess again, said Tuppence. You haven't caught the idea yet. Use your little grey cells, mon ami. Scintillate, Watson. Be a bull that has been more than 10 minutes in the arena. Wait a minute, said Tommy. I begin to see. There is a dark purpose in this. What are you going to wear, Tuppence? An old suit of your clothes, an American hat, and some horn spectacles. Crude, said Tommy, but I catch the idea. McCarty, incog, and I'm Reardon. That's it. I thought we ought to practice American detective methods as well as English ones. Just for once, I'm going to be the star, and you will be the humble assistant. Don't forget, said Tommy warningly, that it's always an innocent remark by the simple Denny that puts McCarty on the right track. But Tuppence only laughed. She was in high spirits. It was a most successful evening. The crowds, the music, the fantastic dresses, everything conspired to make the young couple enjoy themselves. Tommy forgot his role of the bored husband dragged out against his will. At 11:50, they drove off in the car to the famous, or infamous, Ace of Spades. As Tuppence had said, it was an underground den, mean and tawdry in appearance, but it was nevertheless crowded with couples in fancy dress. There were closed-in booths round the walls, and Tommy and Tuppence secured one of these. They left the doors purposely a little ajar, so that they could see what was going on outside. I wonder which they are. Our people, I mean, said Tuppence. What about that Columbine over there, with the red Mephistopheles? I fancy the wicked Mandarin, the lady who calls herself a battleship. More of a fast cruiser, I should say. Isn't he witty, said Tuppence. All done on a little drop of drink. Who's this coming in dressed as the Queen of Hearts? Rather a good get-up, that. The girl in question passed into the booth next to them, accompanied by her escort, who was the gentleman dressed in newspaper from Alice in Wonderland. They were both wearing masks. It seemed to be rather a common custom at the Ace of Spades. I'm sure we're in a real den of iniquity, said Tuppence with a pleased face. Scandals all round us. What a row everyone makes. A cry, as of protest, rang out from the booth next door and was covered by a man's loud laugh. Everybody was laughing and singing. The shrill voices of the girls rose above the booming of their male escorts. What about that shepherdess? Demanded Tommy. The one with the comic Frenchman. They might be our little lot. Anyone might be, confessed Tuppence. I'm not going to bother. The great thing is that we're enjoying ourselves. I could have enjoyed myself better in another costume, grumbled Tommy. You've no idea of the heat of this one. Cheer up, said Tuppence. You look lovely. I'm glad of that, said Tommy. It's more than you do. You're the funniest little guy I've ever seen. Will you keep a civil tongue in your head, Denny? Hello. The gentleman in newspaper is leaving his lady alone. Where's he going, do you think? Going to hurry up the drinks, I expect, said Tommy. I wouldn't mind doing the same thing. He's a long time doing it, said Tuppence, when 4 or 5 minutes had passed. Tommy, would you think me an awful ass? She paused. Suddenly she jumped up. Call me an ass if you like. I'm going in next door. Look here, Tuppence, you can't. I've a feeling there's something wrong. I know there is. Don't try and stop me. She passed quickly out of their own booth, and Tommy followed her. The doors of the one next door were closed. Tuppence pushed them apart and went in, Tommy on her heels. The girl, dressed as the Queen of Hearts, sat in the corner, leaning up against the wall in a queer, huddled position. Her eyes regarded them steadily through her mask, but she did not move. Her dress was carried out in a bold design of red and white, but on the left-hand side the pattern seemed to have got mixed. There was more red than there should have been. With a cry, Tuppence hurried forward. At the same time, Tommy saw what she had seen, the hilt of a jeweled dagger just below the heart. Tuppence dropped on her knees by the girl's side. Quick, Tommy! She's still alive. Get hold of the manager and make him get a doctor at once. Right. Mind you don't touch the handle of that dagger, Tuppence. I'll be careful. Go quickly. Tommy hurried out, pulling the doors to behind him. Tuppence passed her arm round the girl. The latter made a faint gesture, and Tuppence realized that she wanted to get rid of the mask. Tuppence unfastened it gently. She saw a fresh, flower-like face and wide, starry eyes that were full of horror, suffering, and a kind of dazed bewilderment. My dear, said Tuppence very gently, can you speak at all? Will you tell me, if you can, who did this? She felt the eyes fix themselves on her face. The girl was sighing, the deep palpitating sighs of a failing heart. And still she looked steadily at Tuppence. Then her lips parted.
Bingo did it,
she said in a strained whisper. Then her hands relaxed, and she seemed to nestle down on Tuppence's shoulder. Tommy came in, two men with him. The bigger of the two came forward with an air of authority, the word doctor written all over him. Tuppence relinquished her burden.
She's dead, I'm afraid, she said with a catch in her voice.
The doctor made a swift examination. Yes, he said. Nothing to be done. We had better leave things as they are till the police come. How did the thing happen? Tuppence explained rather haltingly, slurring over her reasons for entering the booth. It's a curious business, said the doctor. You heard nothing?
I heard her give a kind of cry, but then the man laughed. Naturally, I didn't think...
Naturally not, agreed the doctor. And the man wore a mask, you say? You wouldn't recognize him?
I'm afraid not. Would you, Tommy?
No. Still, there is his costume. The first thing will be to identify this poor lady, said the doctor. After that, well, I suppose the police will get down to things pretty quickly. It ought not to be a difficult case. Ah, here they come. The gentleman dressed in newspaper. It was after 3 o'clock when, weary and sick at heart, the husband and wife reached home. Several hours passed before Tuppence could sleep. She lay tossing from side to side, seeing always that flower-like face with the horror-stricken eyes. The dawn was coming in through the shutters when Tuppence finally dropped off to sleep. After the excitement, she slept heavily and dreamlessly. It was broad daylight when she awoke to find Tommy up and dressed, standing by the bedside, shaking her gently by the arm. Wake up, old thing. Inspector Marriott and another man are here and want to see you.
What time is it?
Just on 11. I'll get Alice to bring you your tea right away.
Yes, do. Tell Inspector Marriott I'll be there in 10 minutes.
A quarter of an hour later, Tuppence came hurrying into the sitting room. Inspector Marriott, who was sitting looking very straight and solemn, rose to greet her.
Good morning, Mrs. Beresford. This is Sir Arthur Merivale.
Tuppence shook hands with a tall, thin man with haggard eyes and greying hair.
It's about this sad business last night, said Inspector Marriott. I want Sir Arthur to hear from your own lips what you told me. The words the poor lady said before she died. Sir Arthur has been very hard to convince.
I can't believe, said the other, and I won't believe that Bingo Hale ever hurt a hair of Vere's head.
Inspector Marriott went on.
We've made some progress since last night, Mrs. Beresford, he said. First of all, we managed to identify the lady as Lady Merivale. We communicated with Sir Arthur here. He recognized the body at once and was horrified beyond words, of course. Then I asked him if he knew anyone called Bingo.
You must understand, Mrs. Beresford, said Sir Arthur, that Captain Hale, who is known to all his friends as Bingo, is the dearest pal I have. He practically lives with us. He was staying at my house when they arrested him this morning. I cannot but believe that you have made a mistake. It was not his name that my wife uttered.
There is no possibility of mistake, said Tuppence gently. She said, Bingo did it.
You see, Sir Arthur, said Marriott.
The unhappy man sank into a chair and covered his face with his hands.
It's incredible. What earthly motive could there be? Oh, I know your idea, Inspector Marriott. You think Hale was my wife's lover. But even if that was so, which I don't admit for a moment, what motive was there for killing her?
Inspector Marriott coughed.
It's not a very pleasant thing to say, sir, but Captain Hale has been paying a lot of attention to a certain young American lady of late. A young lady with a considerable amount of money. If Lady Merivale liked to turn nasty, she could probably stop his marriage.
This is outrageous, Inspector.
Sir Arthur sprang angrily to his feet. The other calmed him with a soothing gesture.
I beg your pardon, I'm sure, Sir Arthur. You say that you and Captain Hale both decided to attend this show.
Your wife was away on a visit at the time, and you had no idea that she was to be there.
Not the least idea.
Just show him that advertisement you told me about, Mrs. Beresford.
Tuppence complied.
That seems to me clear enough. It was inserted by Captain Hale to catch your wife's eye. They had already arranged to meet there. But you only made up your mind to go the day before, hence it was necessary to warn her. That is the explanation of the phrase, necessary to finesse the king. You ordered your costume from a theatrical firm at the last minute, but Captain Hale's was a homemade affair. He went as the gentleman dressed in newspaper. And do you know, Sir Arthur, what we found clasped in the dead lady's hand? A fragment torn from a newspaper. My men have orders to take Captain Hale's costume away with them from your house. I shall find it at the yard when I get back. If there's a tear in it corresponding to the missing piece, well, it'll be the end of the case.
He won't find it, said Sir Arthur. I know Bingo Hale.
Apologizing to Tuppence for disturbing her, they took their leave. Late that evening, there was a ring at the bell, and somewhat to the astonishment of the young pair, Inspector Marriott once more walked in.
I thought Blunt's brilliant detectives would like to hear the latest developments, he said with a hint of a smile.
Well, they would, said Tommy. Have a drink? He placed materials hospitably at Inspector Marriott's elbow.
It's a clear case, said the latter, after a minute or two. Dagger was the lady's own. The idea was to have made it look like suicide, evidently. But thanks to you two being on the spot, that didn't come off. We found plenty of letters. They'd been carrying on together for some time, that's clear, without Sir Arthur tumbling to it. Then we found the last link.
The last what? Said Tuppence sharply.
The last link in the chain. That fragment of the Daily Leader. It was torn from the dress he wore. Fits exactly. Oh, yes. It's a perfectly clear case. By the way, I brought round a photograph of those two exhibits. I thought they might interest you. It's very seldom that you get such a perfectly clear case.
Tommy, said Tuppence, when her husband had returned from showing the Scotland Yard man out, why do you think Inspector Marriott keeps repeating that it's a perfectly clear case?
I don't know. Smug satisfaction, I suppose.
Not a bit of it. He's trying to get us irritated. You know, Tommy, butchers, for instance, know something about meat, don't they?
Well, I should say so, but what on earth?
And in the same way, greengrocers know all about vegetables, and fishermen about fish. Detectives, professional detectives, must know all about criminals. They know the real thing when they see it, and they know when it isn't the real thing. Marriott's expert knowledge tells him that Captain Hale isn't a criminal, but all the facts are dead against him. As a last resource, Marriott is egging us on, hoping against hope that some little detail or other will come back to us, something that happened last night, which will throw a different light on things. Tommy, why shouldn't it be suicide after all?
Well, remember what she said to you.
I know, but take that a different way. It was Bingo's doing. His conduct that drove her to kill herself. It's just possible.
Just, but it doesn't explain that fragment of newspaper.
Let's have a look at Marriott's photographs. I forgot to ask him what Hale's account of the matter was.
Well, I asked him that in the hall just now. Hale declared he had never spoken to Lady Merivale at the show. Says somebody shoved a note in his hand which said, "Don't try and speak to me tonight. Arthur suspects." He couldn't produce the piece of paper, though, and it doesn't sound a very likely story.
Anyway, you and I know he was with her at the Ace of Spades because we saw him.
Tuppence nodded and pored over the two photographs. One was a tiny fragment with the legend Daily Lee, and the rest torn off. The other was the front sheet of the Daily Leader with the small round tear at the top of it. There was no doubt about it. Those two fitted together perfectly.
What are all those marks down the side? Asked Tommy.
Stitches, said Tuppence, where it was sewn to the others, you know.
I thought it might be a new scheme of dots, said Tommy.
Then he gave a slight shiver.
My word, Tuppence, how creepy it makes one feel. To think that you and I were discussing dots and puzzling over that advertisement, all as light-hearted as anything.
Tuppence did not answer. Tommy looked at her,
and was startled to observe that she was staring ahead of her, her mouth slightly open, and a bewildered expression on her face. "Tuppence," said Tommy gently, shaking her by the arm, "what's the matter with you? Are you just going to have a stroke or something?" But Tuppence remained motionless. Presently she said in a faraway voice, "Dennis Reardon." "Eh?" said Tommy, staring. "It's just as you said. One simple, innocent remark. Find me all this week's Daily Leaders. What are you up to? I'm being McCarty. I've been worrying round, and thanks to you, I've got a notion at last. This is the front sheet of Tuesday's paper. I seem to remember that Tuesday's paper was the one with two dots in the L of leader. This has a dot in the D of daily, and one in the L, too. Get me the papers, and let's make sure." They compared them anxiously. Tuppence had been quite right in her remembrance. "You see, this fragment wasn't torn from Tuesday's paper. But Tuppence, we can't be sure. It may merely be different editions. It may, but at any rate, it's given me an idea. It can't be coincidence, that's certain. There's only one thing it can be, if I'm right in my idea. Ring up Sir Arthur, Tommy. Ask him to come round here at once. Say I've got important news for him. Then get hold of Marriott. Scotland Yard will know his address if he's gone home." Sir Arthur Merivale, very much intrigued by the summons, arrived at the flat in about half an hour's time. Tuppence came forward to greet him. "I must apologise for sending for you in such a peremptory fashion," she said, "but my husband and I have discovered something that we think you ought to know at once. Do sit down." Sir Arthur sat down, and Tuppence went on. "You are, I know, very anxious to clear your friend." Sir Arthur shook his head sadly.
"I was, but even I have had to give in to the overwhelming evidence.
What would you say if I told you that chance has placed in my hands a piece of evidence that will certainly clear him of all complicity?"
"I should be overjoyed to hear it, Mrs. Beresford."
"Supposing," continued Tuppence, "that I had come across a girl who was actually dancing with Captain Hale last night at 12 o'clock, the hour when he was supposed to be at the Ace of Spades."
"Marvellous," cried Sir Arthur. "I knew there was some mistake. Poor Vere must have killed herself after all."
"Hardly that," said Tuppence. "You forget the other man."
"What other man?"
"The one my husband and I saw leave the booth. You see, Sir Arthur, there must have been a second man dressed in newspaper at the ball. By the way, what was your own costume?"
"Mine? I went as a 17th century executioner."
"How very appropriate," said Tuppence softly.
"Appropriate, Mrs. Beresford? What do you mean by appropriate?"
"For the part you played. Shall I tell you my ideas on the subject, Sir Arthur? The newspaper dress is easily put on over that of an executioner. Previously, a little note has been slipped into Captain Hale's hand asking him not to speak to a certain lady. But the lady herself knows nothing of that note. She goes to the Ace of Spades at the appointed time and sees the figure she expects to see. They go into the booth. He takes her in his arms, I think, and kisses her. The kiss of a Judas. And as he kisses, he strikes with the dagger. She only utters one faint cry, and he covers that with a laugh. Presently he goes away, and to the last, horrified and bewildered, she believes her lover is the man who killed her. But she has torn a small fragment from the costume. The murderer notices that. He is a man who pays great attention to detail. To make the case absolutely clear against his victim, the fragment must be seen to have been torn from Captain Hale's costume. That would present great difficulties unless the two men happened to be living in the same house. Then, of course, the thing would be simplicity itself. He makes an exact duplicate of the tear in Captain Hale's costume. Then he burns his own and prepares to play the part of the loyal friend." Tuppence paused. "Well, Sir Arthur?" Sir Arthur rose and made her a bow.
"The rather vivid imagination of a charming lady who reads too much fiction."
"You think so?" said Tommy.
"And a husband who is guided by his wife," said Sir Arthur. "I do not fancy that you will find anybody to take the matter seriously."
He laughed out loud, and Tuppence stiffened in her chair. "I would swear to that laugh anywhere," she said. "I heard it last in the Ace of Spades. and you are under a little misapprehension about us both. Beresford is our real name, but we have another." She picked up a card from the table and handed it to him. Sir Arthur read it aloud.
"International Detective Agency?"
He drew his breath sharply.
"So, that is what you really are. That was why Marriott brought me here this morning. It was a trap."
He strolled to the window.
"A fine view you have from here," he said. "Right over London." "Inspector Marriott," cried Tommy sharply.
In a flash, the inspector appeared from the communicating door in the opposite wall. A little smile of amusement came to Sir Arthur's lips.
"I thought as much," he said. "But you won't get me this time, I'm afraid, Inspector. I prefer to take my own way out."
And putting his hands on the sill, he vaulted clean through the window. Tuppence shrieked and clapped her hands to her ears to shut out the sound she had already imagined, the sickening thud far beneath. Inspector Marriott uttered an oath.
"We should have thought of the window," he said. "Though, mind you, it would have been a difficult thing to prove. I'll go down and see to things."
"Poor devil," said Tommy slowly. "If he was fond of his wife..." But the inspector interrupted him with a snort.
"Fond of her? That's as may be. He was at his wit's end where to turn for money. Lady Merivale had a large fortune of her own, and it all went to him. If she'd bolted with young Hale, he'd never have seen a penny of it."
That was it, was it?
Of course, from the very start, I sensed that Sir Arthur was a bad lot, and that Captain Hale was all right. We know pretty well what's what at the Yard, but it's awkward when you're up against facts. I'll be going down now. I should give your wife a glass of brandy if I were you, Mr. Beresford. It's been upsetting, like, for a...
Greengrocers,
said Tuppence in a low voice as the door closed behind the imperturbable inspector.
Butchers, fishermen, detectives.
I was right, wasn't I? He knew. Tommy, who had been busy at the sideboard, approached her with a large glass. "Drink this."
"What is it? Brandy?"
"No. It's a large cocktail, suitable for a triumphant McCarty." "Yes, Marriott's right all round. That was the way of it. A bold finesse for game and rubber." Tuppence nodded.
"But he finessed the wrong way round."
"And so," said Tommy, "exit the king."
A fruitful Sunday.
"Well, really, I call this too delightful," said Miss Dorothy Pratt for the fourth time. "How I wish the old cat could see me now, she and her Janes."
The old cat, thus scathingly alluded to, was Miss Pratt's highly estimable employer, Mrs. Mackenzie Jones, who had strong views upon the Christian name suitable for parlourmaids, and had repudiated Dorothy in favour of Miss Pratt's despised second name of Jane. Miss Pratt's companion did not reply at once, for the best of reasons. When you have just purchased a baby Austin, fourth hand, for the sum of £20, and are taking it out for the second time only, your whole attention is necessarily focused on the difficult task of using both hands and feet as the emergencies of the moment dictate.
Said
Mr. Edward Palgrove, and negotiated a crisis with a horrible grinding sound that would have set a true motorist's teeth on edge.
"Well, you don't talk much to a girl," complained Dorothy.
Mr. Palgrove was saved from having to respond, as at that moment he was roundly and soundly cursed by the driver of a motor omnibus.
"Well, of all the impudence," said Miss Pratt, tossing her head.
"I only wish he had this footbrake," said her swain bitterly.
"Is there anything wrong with it?"
"Well, you can put your foot on it till kingdom comes," said Mr. Palgrove, "but nothing happens."
"Oh, well, Ted, you can't expect everything for £20. After all, here we are in a real car, on Sunday afternoon, going out of town the same as everybody else."
More grinding and crashing sounds.
"Ah," said Ted, flushed with triumph, "that was a better change." "You do drive something beautiful," said Dorothy admiringly.
Emboldened by feminine appreciation, Mr. Palgrave attempted a dash across Hammersmith Broadway and was severely spoken to by a policeman.
"Well, I never," said Dorothy,
as they proceeded towards Hammersmith Bridge in a chastened fashion.
"I don't know what the police are coming to. You'd think they'd be a bit more civil-spoken, seeing the way they've been shown up lately."
"Anyway, I didn't want to go along this road," said Edward sadly. "I wanted to go down the Great West Road and do a bust."
"And be caught in a trap as likely as not," said Dorothy. "That's what happened to the master the other day. £5, and costs."
"But the police aren't so dusty after all," said Edward generously. "They pitch into the rich, all right. No favour. It makes me mad to think of these swells who can walk into a place, buy a couple of Rolls Royces without turning hair. There's no sense in it. I'm as good as they are."
"And the jewellery," said Dorothy, sighing. "Those shops in Bond Street. Diamonds and pearls and I don't know what. And me with a string of Woolworth's pearls."
She brooded sadly upon the subject. Edward was able once more to give his full attention to his driving. They managed to get through Richmond without mishap. The altercation with the policeman had shaken Edward's nerve. He now took the line of least resistance, following blindly behind any car in front, whenever a choice of thoroughfares presented itself. In this way, he presently found himself following a shady country lane, which many an experienced motorist would have given his soul to find.
"Rather clever turning off the way I did," said Edward, taking all the credit to himself.
"Sweetly pretty, I call it," said Miss Pratt. "And I do declare, there's a man with fruit to sell."
Sure enough, at a convenient corner was a small wicker table with baskets of fruit on it, and the legend, "Eat More Fruit," displayed on a banner.
"How much?"
said Edward apprehensively, when frenzied pulling of the handbrake had produced the desired result.
"Lovely strawberries," said the man in charge.
He was an unprepossessing-looking individual, with a leer.
"Just the thing for the lady. Ripe fruit, fresh-picked. Cherries, too. Genuine English. Have a basket of cherries, lady."
"Well, they do look nice ones," said Dorothy.
"Oh, lovely. That's what they are," said the man, hoarsely. "Bring your luck, lady. That basket will."
He at last condescended to reply to Edward.
2 shillings, sir. And dirt cheap. You'd say so if you knew what was inside that basket."
"Well, they look awfully nice," said Dorothy.
Edward sighed and paid over 2 shillings. His mind was obsessed by calculation. Tea later, petrol. This Sunday motoring business wasn't what you'd call cheap. It was the worst of taking girls out. They always wanted everything they saw.
"Thank you, sir," said the unprepossessing-looking one. "You've got more than your money's worth in that basket of cherries."
Edward shoved his foot savagely down, and the baby Austin leapt at the cherry vendor after the manner of an infuriated Alsatian.
"Sorry," said Edward. "I forgot she was in gear."
"You ought to be careful, dear," said Dorothy. "You might have hurt him."
Edward did not reply. Another half mile brought them to an ideal spot by the banks of a stream. The Austin was left by the side of the road, and Edward and Dorothy sat affectionately upon the river bank and munched cherries. A Sunday paper lay unheeded at their feet.
"What's the news?"
said Edward at last, stretching himself flat on his back and tilting his hat to shade his eyes. Dorothy glanced over the headlines.
"The Woeful Wife. Extraordinary story.
28 people drowned last week.
Reported death of airmen. Startling jewel robbery. Ruby necklace worth £50,000 missing. Oh, Ted, £50,000, just fancy,"
she went on reading.
"The necklace is composed of 21 stones set in platinum and was sent by registered post from Paris. On arrival, the packet was found to contain a few pebbles and the jewels were missing."
"Pinched in the post," said Edward. "The posts in France are awful, I believe."
"I'd like to see a necklace like that," said Dorothy. "All glowing like blood. Pigeon's blood, that's what they call the colour. I wonder what it would feel like to have a thing like that hanging round your neck.
Well, you're never likely to know, my girl, said Edward facetiously. Dorothy tossed her head. Why not, I should like to know? It's amazing the way girls can get on in the world. I might go on the stage.
Girls that behave themselves don't get anywhere, said Edward discouragingly. Dorothy opened her mouth to reply, checked herself, and murmured,
Pass me the cherries. I've been eating more than you have, she remarked. I'll divide up what's left and...
Why? Whatever's this?
At the bottom of the basket.
She drew it out as she spoke. A long, glittering chain of blood-red stones. They both stared at it in amazement.
In the basket, did you say?
Said Edward at last. Dorothy nodded.
Right at the bottom. Under the fruit.
Again they stared at each other.
How did it get there, do you think?
Can't imagine. It's odd, Ted. Just after reading that bit in the paper. About the rubies.
Edward laughed.
You don't imagine you're holding £50,000 in your hand, do you?
I just said it was odd. Rubies set in platinum. Platinum is that sort of dull, silvery stuff. Like this.
Don't they sparkle?
And aren't they a lovely colour? I wonder how many of them there are.
She counted.
I say, Ted, there are 21 exactly.
No.
Yeah, the same number as the paper said. Oh, Ted, you don't think...
Well, it could be. But he spoke irresolutely.
There's some sort of way you can tell. Scratching them on glass.
Oh, that's diamonds. But you know, Ted, that was a very odd-looking man. The man with the fruit. A nasty-looking man. And he was funny about it. Said we got more than our money's worth in the basket.
Yeah, but look here, Dorothy. What would he want to hand us over £50,000 for?
Miss Pratt shook her head, discouraged.
It doesn't seem to make sense, she admitted. Unless the police were after him.
The police?
Edward paled slightly.
Yeah, goes on to say in the paper. The police have a clue.
Cold shivers ran down Edward's spine.
I don't like this, Dorothy. Supposing the police get after us?
Dorothy stared at him with her mouth open.
But we haven't done anything, Ted. We found it in the basket.
Oh, and that'll sound a silly sort of story to tell. It isn't likely.
Well, it isn't very, admitted Dorothy. Oh, Ted, do you really think this is it? It's like a fairy story.
Well, I don't think it sounds like a fairy story, said Edward. It sounds to me more like the kind of story where the hero goes to Dartmoor, unjustly accused for 14 years.
But Dorothy was not listening. She had clasped the necklace round her neck and was judging the effect in a small mirror taken from her handbag.
The same as a duchess might wear, she murmured ecstatically.
I won't believe it, said Edward violently. They're imitation. They must be imitation.
Yes, dear, said Dorothy, still intent on her reflection in the mirror. Very likely.
Anything else would be too much of a coincidence.
Pigeon's blood,
murmured Dorothy.
It's absurd, that's what I say. Absurd. Look here, Dorothy, are you listening to what I say, or are you not?
Dorothy put away the mirror. She turned to him, one hand on the rubies round her neck.
How do I look?
She asked. Edward stared at her, his grievance forgotten. He had never seen Dorothy quite like this. There was a triumph about her, a kind of regal beauty that was completely new to him. The belief that she had jewels round her neck worth £50,000 had made of Dorothy Pratt a new woman. She looked insolently serene, a kind of Cleopatra and Semiramis and Zenobia rolled into one.
You look stunning, said Edward humbly.
Dorothy laughed, and her laugh too was entirely different.
Look here, said Edward. We've got to do something. We must take him to a police station or something.
Nonsense, said Dorothy. You said yourself just now that they wouldn't believe you. You'll probably be sent to prison for stealing them, But what else can we do?
Keep them, said the new Dorothy Pratt. Edward stared at her.
Keep them? You're mad.
We found them, didn't we? Why should we think they're valuable? We'll keep them, and I shall wear them.
And the police will pinch you.
Dorothy considered this for a minute or two.
All right, she said. We'll sell them, and you can buy a Rolls Royce, or two Rolls Royces, and I'll buy a diamond head thing, and some rings.
Still Edward stared. Dorothy showed impatience.
You've got to take your chance now. It's up to you to take it. We didn't steal the thing. I wouldn't hold with that. It's come to us, and it's probably the only chance we'll ever have of getting all the things we want. Haven't you got any spunk at all, Edward Palgrove?
Edward found his voice.
Sell it, you say? That wouldn't be so jolly easy. Any jeweller would want to know where I got the blooming thing.
You don't take it to a jeweller. Don't you ever read detective stories, Ted? You take it to a fence, of course.
And how should I know any fences? I've been brought up respectable.
Men ought to know everything, said Dorothy. That's what they're for.
He looked at her. She was serene and unyielding.
I wouldn't have believed it of you, he said weakly.
I thought you had more spirit.
There was a pause. Then Dorothy rose to her feet.
Well, she said lightly, we'd best be getting home.
We're in that thing round your neck.
Dorothy removed the necklace, looked at it reverently, and dropped it into her handbag.
Look here, said Edward. You give that to me.
No.
Yes, you do. I've been brought up honest, my girl.
Well, you can go on being honest. You need have nothing to do with it.
Oh, hand it over, said Edward recklessly. I'll do it. I'll find a fence. As you say, it's the only chance we shall ever have. We came by it honest, bought it for 2 shillings. It's no more than what gentlemen do in antique shops every day of their life, and are proud of it.
That's it, said Dorothy.
Oh, Edward, you're splendid.
She handed over the necklace, and he dropped it into his pocket. He felt worked up, exalted, the very devil of a fellow. In this mood, he started the Austin. They were both too excited to remember tea. They drove back to London in silence. Once, at a crossroads, a policeman stepped towards the car, and Edward's heart missed a beat. By a miracle, they reached home without mishap. Edward's last words to Dorothy were imbued with the adventurous spirit.
We'll go through with this. £50,000. It's worth it.
He dreamt that night of Broad Arrows and Dartmoor, and rose early, haggard and unrefreshed. He had to set about finding a fence. And how to do it, he had not the remotest idea. His work at the office was slovenly, and brought down upon him 2 sharp rebukes before lunch. How did one find a fence? Whitechapel, he fancied, was the correct neighbourhood, or was it Stepney? On his return to the office, a call came through for him on the telephone. Dorothy's voice spoke, tragic and tearful.
Is that you, Ted? I'm using the telephone, but she may come in any minute, and I'll have to stop. Ted, you haven't done anything, have you?
Edward replied in the negative.
Well, look here, Ted, you mustn't. I've been lying awake all night. It's been awful. Thinking of how it says in the Bible you mustn't steal. I must have been mad yesterday. I really must. You won't do anything, will you, Ted, dear?
Did a feeling of relief steal over Mr. Palgrove? Possibly it did. But he wasn't going to admit any such thing.
When I say I'm going to go through with a thing, I go through with it, he said in a voice such as might belong to a strong superman with eyes of steel.
Oh, but Ted, dear, you mustn't. Oh, Lord, she's coming. Look here, Ted. She's going out to dinner tonight. I can slip out and meet you. Don't do anything till you've seen me. 8 o'clock. Wait for me round the corner.
Her voice changed to a seraphic murmur.
Oh, yes, ma'am. I think it was a wrong number. It was Bloomsbury 0234 they wanted.
As Edward left the office at 6 o'clock, a huge headline caught his eye. Jewel robbery. Latest developments. Hurriedly, he extended a penny. Safely ensconced in the tube, having dexterously managed to gain a seat, He eagerly perused the printed sheet. He found what he sought easily enough. A suppressed whistle escaped him.
Well, I'm...
Then another adjacent paragraph caught his eye. He read it through and let the paper slip to the floor unheeded. Precisely at 8 o'clock, he was waiting at the rendezvous. A breathless Dorothy, looking pale but pretty, came hurrying along to join him.
You haven't done anything, Ted?
I haven't done anything. He took the ruby chain from his pocket. You can put it on.
But Ted...
The police have got the rubies, all right. And the man who pinched them. And now, read this. He thrust a newspaper paragraph under her nose. Dorothy read, New advertising stunt. A clever new advertising dodge is being adopted by the All-English Fivepenny Fair, who intend to challenge the famous Woolworths. Baskets of fruit were sold yesterday and will be on sale every Sunday. Out of every 50 baskets, one will contain an imitation necklace in different coloured stones. These necklaces are really a wonderful value for the money. Great excitement and merriment was caused by them yesterday, and Eat More Fruit will have a great vogue next Sunday. We congratulate the Fivepenny Fair on their resource and wish them all good luck in their campaign of Buy British Goods.
Well, said Dorothy.
And after a pause,
Well!
Yeah, said Edward. I felt the same. A passing man thrust a paper into his hand.
Take one, brother, he said. The price of a virtuous woman is far above rubies, he read.
There, said Edward. I hope that cheers you up.
I don't know, said Dorothy doubtfully. I don't exactly want to look like a good woman.
You don't, said Edward. That's why the man gave me that paper. With those rubies round your neck, you don't look one little bit like a good woman.
Dorothy laughed. You're rather a dear, Ted, she said. Come on, let's go to the pictures.